to the third case, Bloomington Normal Seating Company versus the NLRB. Suerte.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. So Gary Winthrop for Bloomington Seating Company. This is our appeal from the NLRB decision to uphold the ALJ's decision that the employer, through one of its supervisors, Mark Overfeld, threatened one employee, Russell Sears, with termination on September 5, 2001, if he were to start a union. And secondly, the NLRB's decision that despite no evidence that the company interfered with any protected activity, the company again violated Section 8A1 of the Act by warning employees against harassment in the context of union activity. We submit, Your Honors, that the burden is on the ALJ and the NLRB to analyze the facts and articulate reasons for crediting or rejecting evidence and establishing substantial evidence in any case. As this Court stated recently, in Sears, Roebuck & Company split decision published November 17, 2003, the facts really do matter, and the Board's findings should be denied enforcement because, like in Sears, there was a wholesale failure by the ALJ to analyze any of the facts and credibility of the witnesses in this case. Here we have a one-paragraph decision of the Board affirming the ALJ's decision, which failed to make any credibility findings whatsoever, and relied on a discredited presumption that current employees inherently testify credibly. That same ALJ...
Well, he treated it as a factor. I don't see that he treated it, thought that that alone required him to believe these people.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree because there's no evidence other than that presumption in the record that he could have possibly relied on.
What do you mean evidence that they testified, right, and he believed them? You're saying the only reason he believed them was that they were current employees at the time they testified.
That's exactly correct,
but
Your Honor.
But where do you see, I don't see that in his opinion.
He never analyzed demeanor. He never
what
analyzed,
do you analyzed demeanor. You don't have, you don't see opinions where judges say, well, when I listened to his testimony, I noticed he was blinking too much. You know, that's not, that, you don't see that in any of these opinions.
Well, there's nothing in the record that he
discredited. You say, you know, I think you're, I saw him, I thought he was credible, I believed him, and so on.
But there's nothing in the record that he discredited the supervisor over
the Halsey testimony. Had completely credible demeanors. In other words, he's saying, you know, from what he could judge looking at them when they testified, they were credible, credible demeanors, credible appearance. Credible demeanors is different from the business about their being current employees. That's a separate reason why he believed them.
But
their demeanors were credible.
But there's also no credible evidence that he relied upon to make that determination. At least
what
there's
do you
no
mean
analysis.
Credible? Look, when you're talking about a person's demeanor, you're talking about his appearance. That's the evidence. You look at him. You don't have someone coming in and saying, giving evidence that this person has a credible demeanor.
We would submit, Your Honor, that the AOJ has an obligation to articulate reasons as to his
what's
or her
the reason
findings.
For belief for saying someone has a credible demeanor?
That's one factor, I agree. But he also did not analyze any of the evidence.
What do you mean one factor? Someone testifies, what he testifies to is not contrary to the laws of nature, otherwise totally preposterous, and the judge says, well, I believe you, you have a credible demeanor. What more is he supposed to say?
Well, I think he needs to analyze the evidence in
what
the record.
What evidence?
Well,
what evidence did he fail to discuss that he should have discussed?
Well, there's evidence that the threat occurred in the face of undisputed lack of any prior union activity, that he would have the board and the court believe that in the absence of any prior activity on September 5th at approximately 6:15 in the morning, prior to their beginning any work activity where there's no noise, there's no machines running, the supervisor walked into the plant, walks up to this employee that he has known for 6 years and had a friendship with for 6 years, and he had only become a supervisor 2 months prior to that, and saw him reading a publication entitled Union News, and made the determination on that basis that this employee was starting a union, and warned him against the results of his activity.
I don't find that surprising at all. Why do you find it surprising?
I think it's unbelievable in terms of the...
I don't understand what you're talking about. If I were an employer and I didn't want to have a union, and of course a lot of employers, most employers don't want to have unions. So if you saw someone reading a union newspaper, alarm bells would go off. And you'd say, if you didn't realize, you know, you'd get in trouble, you'd say, you know, we don't want unions here. Throw away that magazine. What's implausible about that?
Well, the record is clear that the supervisor's testimony was that he didn't even recognize it as
the
union
testimony.
Newspaper.
The judge doesn't have to believe his testimony just because he's your witness. You think it's somehow incredible that a supervisor would react to seeing a union newspaper. I don't see why you think that's incredible.
Well, you'd have to make the determination that that supervisor was, number one, anti-union and was taking the position solely based on that newspaper.
Well, I think the company is anti-union. That's a fair. They didn't want a union here.
Well, there's undisputed evidence in the record that this individual had only been a supervisor for 2 months and had 6 years previously been a peer of this individual.
That's your conjecture. That's your speculation. That hardly shows that Sears was lying.
Well, the evidence indicated that for 6 years there had never been, and Sears testified that
right,
there never
had
been
had
any
a union, and they certainly
union
they never had a union. They certainly didn't want to start.
But there was no testimony that there was any indication that Sears had ever previously had any discussions with the supervisor about unions in general, or his support or non-support for unions in general, and that out of the blue he walked up to this individual and made this comment. There's no evidence that there's any follow-up to that. The employee was never disciplined. There was never a termination. There was no other evidence to support any 8-1 violations. In fact, the complaint...
Doesn't the statute, though, really vest the ALJ with the authority to make these kinds of determinations? He's the guy who's supposed to know a lot about labor-management relations, supposed to be able to assess the facts in that context, and he did it here. He said, yeah, this isn't a good situation.
We would submit, Your Honor, that that's exactly what the ALJ should have done, but he didn't do that. There was absolutely no explanation of the reasoning behind his conclusions.
Could we turn to your second point?
Yes,
on that, and I'd like you to address specifically that point. Why didn't the ALJ give a sufficient explanation as to why that remark by the supervisor to the group of employees amounted to intimidation and coercion?
Are you talking about the harassment?
Yeah.
The speech,
yeah,
from the plant manager?
The whole thing turns on the word harass, right?
Exactly. And the board would have us believe that the sole basis for the 8-1 finding was because that kind of a statement can chill Section 7 protected activity, which in light of today's standards with respect to harassment in the workplace and the burdens placed on employers to prevent harassment
ALJ
in the workplace.
But the ALJ, I think, makes a good point when the ALJ says that none of that kind of harassment, the type of harassment forbidden by Title VII, is really at stake here. I mean, it's pretty clear that this was simply an organizational situation, and that the management fellow was talking about harassment in the context of an organizational situation. Is that really beyond the pale?
I don't believe that's entirely true, because the statement in the speech was harassment of any kind, and the employer's policy would support that.
But that's sound by advocacy. You're taking that phrase and you're culling that out of the entire entire address of the manager, and the ALJ takes the position you've got to assess the remark in context of the speech he was giving. Why is that unreasonable?
Well, in light of the fact that the board's sole argument is the chilling effect on individuals, that in today's day and age, in fact, what often happens is the first thing that you see in a campaign, a union campaign, is that the employer receives a letter from the union identifying all of its supporters by name And that's solely done to identify those individuals to protect them from discipline or termination because of their union activities. So there's no real protection for identification of individuals that really needs that kind of protection. There's no chilling effect here. No one was disciplined. No one came forward with any evidence.
There is a decent amount of both board law and a few circuit cases which basically say, hey, don't use the word harass.
And we submit, Your Honor, that in this day and age, that in light of the evolution of the harassment cases, it's time to take another look at that standard, that it's inappropriate to simply base a decision on harassment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Winstead. Mr. Rosenfeld.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Arthur Rosenfeld, General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board. The Board is not always right. Sometimes the Board makes mistakes and changes direction. In this particular matter, the Board has said that when you use the term harassment and you tie it to solicitation of union cards, it either interferes, restrains, or coerces the employees in the exercise of their Section 7 rights. The Board is entitled or should be given deference in that matter.
Something about the word, sir. I mean, if I were sitting in the general counsel's office of a major corporation today, should I just simply put out the word, never in an organizational situation, just never use the word harass? Is that basically what the Board has said?
I would agree with that. That would be the advice I would give my client.
Black now you can letter, do black letter rule?
It's not black letter law, although there's a body of board law, and there's a body of law that indicates that harassment chills. The term harassment chills.
So if I'm the human resources guy, and my lawyer is going to have to say to me now, you can tell the folks that we will protect them from threats, but you can't tell them we'll protect you from harassment. So that's the law of the land. Am I right?
Yes and no. I think you could say.
See, these guys need some answers out there.
Well,
you look at this law, and it's not, frankly, as I think well settled as you'd like us to think. And I'm concerned about what we might say in this opinion.
The reason I hesitate, Your Honor, is that the term harassment is becoming a term of art in all sorts of contexts.
Mm-hmm.
Sexual harassment under Title VII. And it may be that there may be language in a handbook, for example, that says if you are harassed in a certain circumstance, please report it to your supervisor. We, the employer, have an obligation to police and prohibit that type of conduct. The case we have in front of us is very, very different and very clear. What the employer said was, I'm going to protect you guys. I know there's an organizing campaign going on. If anybody comes after you and harasses you, whatever that means, to sign a card, tell me. And so that chills those folks who are exercising legitimately Section 7 rights. That may lead folks to believe, employees to believe, that this is an employer's way of finding out who the union adherents are. It may stymie individuals in soliciting. And all of these are legitimate activities on the part of the employee. So this is a very different case.
And so what happens to the employee who is greeted at the car in the parking lot in the morning and simply cannot get somebody out of her face until she gets to her place on the line, can't take a break for any purpose without having somebody in her face, can't get back to her car without having the same episode, can't eat her lunch without the same episode. She can't say, look, I came here to work, I don't want this guy in my face, and I think I've got a right to that protection. According to your view is the company can't help her.
Well, I think I think we could draw fact patterns where you cross the line from harassment to bullying.
Well, you see, if you want this line between threat and harassment, I think you got to help us draw that line, and that's where I got a problem.
Well, in terms of harassment, it's true, and it can happen, that in the parking lot, that employee can be besieged day in and day out. Perhaps in the lunchroom, that employee can be besieged day in and day out. While that employee is working, during working time, no. Then you get into Republic Aviation, rights to manage,
right,
and all that sort of thing. But the bottom line is, with that employee who is besieged and harassed, vote against the union. Talk to your fellow employees.
That doesn't do very much for your hypertension in the weeks before the election, does it?
It probably does not.
And so the NLRB says let's have a free-for-all at the workplace until that day.
Well, the board's never said that, but with all due respect, but...
I mean, it's not going to be the sum result in the real world of labor relations.
I don't think so.
Are not polite places.
I think what you have here, Your Honor, is a case of clear use of a term with an intent to chill. I mean, the employer is saying, I'm the iron fist in the velvet glove.
Did he say that, though? Did the ALJ say that? That's part of my problem is that I could see you've got a very valid point in saying, the word harassed shouldn't be used as a hand in the velvet glove, but I just wonder if the ALJ's got to say more than he said here.
Well, but what the ALJ seemed to say is, and what the board has said and what the courts have said, is when you use the term harassment and where there's a nexus between that term and legitimate union activity, be it soliciting for cards, being a promoter of the union, it is on its face violative because it chills legitimate activity. And that's all we're saying. If we had a fact pattern where the individual couldn't breathe, I don't know how that would be dealt with, but if indeed that individual were harassed constantly at home by telephone, by knocks on the door, by the union saying, you have to sign this card, you have to sign this card, and it may happen. That's beyond the purview of the statute.
Yes, sir. Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Did you want to complete that?
No, that's...
to the average a worker who receives a communication about threatened or harassment, and recognizing harassment has, as you appropriately pointed out, picked up a special meaning, certainly in Title VII. Do you think it really imparts a meaningful distinction when those words are co-joined in a... I mean, to say it from the employer to an employee, if you're threatened or harassed, shouldn't we look at it more in, as you have suggested, another context, the fact pattern, rather than have an absolute rule, perhaps suggesting that if you use harassment, it can carry with it a presumption, but shouldn't we confine it to the facts rather than come up with a ban on a word?
In all honesty, I think that's what's happening. That's the movement of the law. Whereas the board a number of years ago may have found the term threatened to be vague.
Right.
They backed away. The board's backed away from that.
You used the word yourself of the speech a little while ago.
Yeah.
In certain contexts, that seems to me to be could be very specific, but also could be kind of vague. So we wouldn't want, would the board not want besieged as a word of communication between an employer and employee?
If we could only convince employers to do what we think is, use the words we think are correct.
How about bothered?
Yeah.
Could you say if you've been bothered? Would that chill union activity?
Definitely, sure. I mean, again, it depends on the context.
That's what I'm suggesting.
Well, and that's what we have here. I can't go beyond that, although I understand what you're asking. But if you say, hey, if those union guys bother you, let me know. Now, if you say, if you're sexually harassed, and this is during an organizing campaign, well, I think we have a different situation. Organizing campaigns are not necessarily pretty occurrences. And unfortunately, or the nature of the beast, much goes on during campaigns. All the board tries to do is police it to the best of its ability. And in this case, what they've asked is that the employer post a notice saying it will cease and desist from certain activity. Any other questions?
Thank you. Mr. Winsick, I think your time had expired, but you may have a minute if you wish.
Your Honor, Section 7 rights also protect an employee's right not to participate in union activities, and exactly as General Counsel has stated, that this he seems to be promoting a lack of civility in the workplace. that the employees need to look to an employer for protection when they're harassed, when they're threatened, when they're bothered to the extent that it's a violation of the law, and it needs to be done on a case-by-case analysis. There can't be a broad-brushed approach, especially in light of the obligations an employer has in today's work environment to protect all individuals against harassment. That's not just sexual harassment. I have yet to see in 20 years of practice a policy that says employees are prohibited from engaging in acts of harassment, except it's got a caveat that says, except if they're engaging in protected activities under Section 7 of the Act. I have yet to see that, and that seems to be what the General Counsel was promoting, and that's not what we're here to have happen. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.